We now begin with one of the main diagnostic categories in the DSM-IV. One of the main diagnostic categories in AXIS 1 is schizophrenia. Schizophrenia, I'm sure you've all heard about. We're going to take some time to review the basics, make sure you have a clear sense about the particulars. What are the symptoms of schizophrenia? Well, we start with bizarre delusions. Delusions are false beliefs that are not culturally verified. If you live in a South Pacific island and you believe throwing a virgin in the volcano will stop the volcano from erupting, that's not a delusion, that's a religion. Delusions are things that, false beliefs that you believe that other people do not share. And I say bizarre delusions. If you think there are spaceships with aliens in them orbiting the Earth, monitoring what happens on Earth, that's just a delusion. If you believe there is an alien base on the dark side of the moon, and they are beaming rays into your head in particular, telling you what the right answer is on the USMLE exam, and that if you wear a baseball cap lined with a special brand of aluminum foil, you will receive these answers. Now we're getting into a bizarre delusion. Hallucinations, by contrast, are about sensory input. Hallucinations is when you have a sensory impression when there is nothing there. You see something when nothing's there, you hear something when there's nothing to hear. Illusions, by contrast, are misperceptions of existing stimuli. That is, there is something, but you're seeing it wrong. There is something, but you're hearing it wrong. Schizophrenics are characterized by hallucinations, yes, but by auditory hallucinations. And notice, about 75% of schizophrenics have auditory hallucinations. That means not every schizophrenic does. As far as you're concerned, on your USMLE exam, visual hallucinations are a rule-out criterion for schizophrenia. If your patient is presented with visual hallucinations, it's probably an organic problem. Alcohol withdrawal, for example, not schizophrenia. Blunted affect. We mean the patient has a lack of affective expression. Their demeanor, their communication may be expressionless, may be more like this, sort of robotic. Loose associations, leaping from one thing to the next in a way that makes sense to you but doesn't make sense to most other people. Deficiency in reality testing and disturbances in behavior, the form and content of language and thought. What do we mean by form and content? Form, we mean the way the ideas come out. Content, we mean what the ideas are about. If I think I'm Napoleon, what are we talking about? Form or content? That's a content issue. It's about who I think I am. And changes in psychomotor behavior. Yes, one of the earliest, indeed incipient signs of schizophrenia is the loss of a natural gracefulness of motion. As I talk to you, my voice has inflection, my hands move, my head moves, I gesture. We call this prosody. This is natural gracefulness of motion. Schizophrenics lose this early on. Their actions become, their movements become mechanical, rigid, somehow at least ungraceful, and seemingly unhuman. Now we need to differentiate schizophrenia from two similar disorders. Schizophreniform disorder is simply, well, when you have the symptoms, the signs of schizophrenia, but less than 6 months. Schizophreniform can result because the patient is taking some sort of bizarre pharmacology, or they can simply result because the schizophrenic episode is self-limiting. Brief psychotic disorder means you only have these symptoms between 1 and 30 days, and it's critical that you return to your full level of former functioning. That is, after 30 days, you see nothing that would indicate this person ever had that psychotic break. The differential here should be relatively easy because time, any length of time of having the symptoms, suggests schizophrenia, not one or the other in the differential. Let's talk about the epidemiology. The onset for males is in general earlier than for females. 15 to 24 for males, 25 to 44 to 34 for females. Prevalence. But 1% of the population cross-culturally is schizophrenic. So now you know, wherever you go in the world, over to Asia, over to Africa, roughly 1% of the population is schizophrenic. Isn't that comforting to know? Downward drift to low SES. Yes, schizophrenics tend to collect in the lower SES part of the population. Why? Well, schizophrenia is in part, as we'll see in a moment, inherited. Because of that, people that are low SES who are schizophrenic tend to spawn other schizophrenics. Secondly, if you're schizophrenic, your odds of completing a long, good education, holding a good job are much reduced, and so by definition, you end up in lower, not high SES area. About half of all schizophrenic patients do attempt suicide. As mentioned previously, 10% do eventually succeed. About half of all schizophrenics do not live with their families, nor are they institutionalized. Where are they? Living out with the rest of us. And if you think about them only as people on the street, that's not quite correct. Many schizophrenics hold jobs, live perfectly normal lives. You don't know they're schizophrenic unless they might tell you that they are. Genetics. Concordance rates for monozygotic twins that are reared apart are identical to concordance rates for monozygotic twins that are raised together, about 47%, suggesting that it's the genetic underpinning that matters most, not the environment, that's certainly not the environment by itself. Concordance rates for dizygotic twins are substantially less, supporting this notion that there is a clear genetic substrate. If both your parents are schizophrenics, you have about a 40% chance of being schizophrenic. If it's only one parent or sibling, your chance is roughly 12%. Let's talk about the heritability index. The heritability index is our way of computing what proportion of not only schizophrenia, but indeed any disorder is due to genetic causes. It's a simple formula. Monozygotic concordance minus dizygotic concordance divided by 100 minus dizygotic concordance equals HI, the heritability index. It tells you what proportion of any condition is due to inheritance. Well, let's use the figures we had in the previous slide, and let's use that heritability index to do a simple calculation. Tell me, what proportion of schizophrenia is due to inheritance? Well, let's see. We have monozygotic minus dizygotic divided by 100 minus dizygotic. So that's 47 minus 13 divided by 100 minus 13. That turns out to be what? 87 on the bottom and 34 on the top. When you work out the math in more detail, it comes out to roughly 40%. Roughly 40% of being schizophrenic is due to inheritance. I tell you again, we want you to use this formula not only for schizophrenia, but anytime you're asked what proportion of any disorder is due to inheritance. Here are two terms related to schizophrenia that are often much misunderstood, but show up on the exam with a fair degree of regularity. What do we mean by the schizophrenogenic family? Well, we want you to understand that term, although it sounds like it relates to schizophrenia, is not really linked to the development of schizophrenia. It's linked much more to the schizoid personality disorder. We'll talk about personality disorders a little bit later. Schizophrenogenic family, these are families that are highly critical. They have a lot of negative emotions, a lot of double messages. What do we mean by double messages? Come here, daddy loves you. Whack, whack, whack. Double messages. This tends to not produce schizophrenics, but does produce people that have a schizoid personality disorder. Second, high expressed emotion families. High expressed emotion families, these are families that have a lot of emotion. There's a lot of ambient emotion always in the household. They're happy, they're sad, there's just emotion all the time. High expressed emotion does not make people schizophrenic, but if they are schizophrenic, it increases the chance for relapse. If your patient comes from a high expressed emotion family and you discharge them into that family, the relapse rate is 4 to 5 times higher than the average population. Why? They can't handle that intense emotion. Schizophrenics literally are not wired to be able to handle and deal with the intensity of that emotionality. In addition to understanding the general characteristics about schizophrenia, you're expected to be able to do a differential diagnosis among the subtypes. Let's talk our way through the subtypes, beginning with paranoid schizophrenia. Paranoid schizophrenia is characterized by basic delusions, delusions of grandeur or persecution. Grandeur, you're great and wonderful. Persecution, they're out to get you. Or maybe they're out to get you because you're great and wonderful. I don't know. often accompanied by auditory hallucinations. These can take even the clarity of voices. Let's pause for a second and just talk briefly about auditory hallucinations. Here's a question. When a schizophrenic is having auditory hallucinations, what defense mechanism is this? That's a tough one. So here's a hint. If you look at the brain functioning of schizophrenics when they're having auditory hallucinations, Broca's area is active. Translation, the schizophrenic is talking to themselves, but they perceive not that they are talking, they perceive that the talk is coming from out there. Auditory hallucinations are the result of what defense mechanism? Projection. They are doing the talking, but they see it as outside. Paranoid schizophrenics are, in some sense, less regressed. They are not as schizophrenic as others. Yes, they do have the disorder. I don't mean to minimize that. But they're not as strange or bizarre or as difficult to deal with. Catatonic. There are two kinds of catatonic schizophrenia. We call it stuporist and excited types. You need to be clear about the difference and the subtypes. Stuporists, we're talking about pronounced decrease in motion. They may sit, stand, or lay in the same position for days, weeks, even documented cases of years on end. In milder forms, they may simply be mute, unspeaking, or they're given to negativism. Whatever you tell them to do, no, they won't do it. Or echopraxia, they copy whatever motions you do. You do something, they do it, as if they're the mirror of you. Or automatic obedience. You tell them to do something and they do exactly what you say. You say to your catatonic patient, go to your room, and they walk over, step inside the door of the room, and they stand there. You come by 2 hours later, they're still standing there. Why? Because they're trying to screw with your head? No. They just did exactly what you told them. They went to the room. Schizophrenics are very concrete in their interpretations. They take exactly what you said, and that's what they process. Now, they can also sit or stand in sometimes extraordinary positions for long periods of time. I knew one catatonic who stood for about 4 days like this, hand in the air, unmoving for 4 days. Try that yourself sometime. Hold your arm up. Let me know how long you can keep it up. Most of you won't make it past 2 minutes, yet I've seen catatonics do that for days. Now, even though they're standing, sitting, lying there, unmoving, we want you to never forget that there is a real person there. You see, as you're walking by the man just standing here, he's likely as not as you walk by to kick you in the pants and be back with his hand above the head. Sorry about that, gang. By the time you turn around again. Alternatively, catatonics can be of the excited type. Excited catatonics, they evidence extreme motor agitation to the point where they're violent or destructive. Now, they don't mean to be violent or destructive. There's just so much motion, they're literally bouncing off the walls. They go so hard and so fast, they run over people, they run into walls, they collapse in exhaustion. In milder forms, they can have repetitious stereotype behavior where they just do the same thing over and over and over again. I knew one gentleman, the excited type of catatonic, who would get up every day and he would just sit there and slap his face in rhythm, almost like a metronome. You tell him it was time to come to dinner, he'd go have dinner, go back and sit there and start slapping his face again. This is the more excited type of catatonic. Please be clear, catatonia can be either the stuporous type, pronounced decrease in motion, or alternatively, they can be the excited type with excessive, uncontrolled, to the point of exhaustion motion. The third type of schizophrenia is called disorganized. Disorganized schizophrenia, these people are, well, not to put too fine a point on it, really, really crazy. They're incoherent, they're primitive. To say they're uninhibited really doesn't give you the picture you need to have. I want you to think about the strangest, most bizarre behavior you can think of and then take it up by a factor of 2 to 3. There's a lot of activity here, but it's active. It's aimless, rather. There's no clear goal. There's no clear direction. To say their personal appearance is poor doesn't really give you the picture. I mean, whether they wear clothes or not, they don't care. Whether they bathe or not, they don't care. They go to the bathroom, they're as likely as not to sit in it, eat it, or write on the walls with it. We're talking about that kind of lack of control over their behavior. In milder forms, you might simply have the explosive laugh. For no apparent reason. Or sometimes, they're just really silly, laughing for reasons you can't ascertain. Or sometimes, manifestation is simply incongruous grinning. Many of the textbooks show you off in the corner of the textbook, the disorganized schizophrenic with this grin. Looks something like this. Best I can do for you without, or now that I'm on my medications. Undifferentiated type. Undifferentiated, these are people that have clear psychotic symptoms, but they don't fit cleanly into any of the other categories we've talked about. Either they don't have these other kinds of symptoms, or more likely, they share symptoms from all the groups, so they don't fit into any one particular group. They're schizophrenic, yes, but they don't fit any of the other subtypes, therefore you fall into this group of undifferentiated. Residual, these are patients that have been schizophrenic, have had clear, positive, prominent symptoms of schizophrenia, but now they don't really seem to have many. Oh, they may have a few lingering negative symptoms. I'll just describe those in detail in just a moment, but they don't have the gross, manifest psychotic behavior. If they were psychotic in the past, schizophrenic, and now they don't have that behavior, your correct diagnosis is residual. Let's talk about what we mean by the terms positive and negative symptoms. Positive symptoms, these are things that schizophrenics have that normal people do not have. Positive doesn't mean positive here as in something good, it means positive as in a plus sign, something added. These are add-ons. Normal people don't have hallucinations, schizophrenics do. That's a positive symptom. Normal people don't have bizarre delusions. Schizophrenics do. That's a positive symptom. Associate these positive symptoms with the action of the dopamine receptors. Negative symptoms. Negative symptoms are what normal people have that schizophrenics lack. Negative doesn't mean bad here. Negative means as in something subtracted, something missing. Normal people have freedom of motion. Schizophrenics don't. They have motor retardation. Normal people have simple emotional expression. Schizophrenics don't. They have flat affect. Normal people give a damn. Schizophrenics don't. They have apathy. These are negative symptoms. We want you to associate these negative symptoms with the muscarinic receptors. Schizoaffective disorder. Schizoaffective disorder means you have all the symptoms of schizophrenia, but in addition, all the symptoms of an affective disorder, bipolar disorder, or more commonly, major depression. Both sets of symptoms are there at the same time. You therefore don't fit cleanly into either affective disorders or into schizophrenia. Schizoaffective disorder is a blanket catch-all that gives us a descriptor for these people. Here's my best bet for the exam. This is probably not your right answer on the Step 1 exam. Schizoaffective disorder is relatively uncommon and not likely to be tested at the level of the Step 1 exam. Predictors of good prognosis. Schizophrenics are more likely to recover if they're paranoid or catatonic subtype than if they're disorganized or undifferentiated. Later onset means more chance of recovery. That is, women have a higher chance of recovery than men do. Quick onset means better recovery than a slow, gradual, insidious decline. Having a lot of positive symptoms means a better chance of recovery, partly because many of our medical pharmacologic interventions work on the positive symptoms. And if you have no family history of schizophrenia, if you do have family history of a mood disorder, and you have the absence of some of the structural brain anomalies we'll talk about in just a moment, your chances of recovery are much enhanced. Neurochemical issues. What's the neurochemistry of schizophrenia? Well, the first of this is widely known, has been known for about 30 to 35 years, the dopamine hypothesis. Schizophrenia is at least in part the result of a hyperactive dopamine system. Much of our pharmacologic intervention is an attempt to reduce the dopamine levels. But it's not only dopamine that's important here. There are other neurotransmitters. A lot of neurotransmitters have been cited as having a contributing influence on schizophrenia. But for the exam, I want you to focus on two in particular. First, serotonin, 5-HT. Serotonin is implicated in a wide variety of behaviors, including impulse control. And we remind you that in a number of areas of the brain, schizophrenia works inversely with dopamine. Dopamine rises, serotonin falls, etc. These are the reason why we think about serotonin as associated with schizophrenia. First, LSD targets the serotonin receptors and can make people look and act schizophrenic. Secondly, the atypical antipsychotics, clozapine being an example, have a high affinity for the serotonin receptors and provide symptom relief for schizophrenics. Since we're getting relief when the serotonin receptors, serotonin must be implicated. Third, we find some genetic defects in the genes that control serotonin production and regulation in people that are schizophrenic. The other neurotransmitter we want you to associate with schizophrenia is glutamate. Glutamate is responsible for our level of expectation, for the level of activity, and seems to be associated with some of the increased activity levels we find in various types of schizophrenia. I want you to associate this at least in part. Schizophrenia is an attention deficit disorder. We have the following evidence to give you to try to support this idea. First is the smooth pursuit eye movement task, what we call SPEM. For this task, we simply ask people without moving their heads to follow some simple device like a pendulum with their eyes. Normal people do this simple task perfectly without any errors. Schizophrenics have great difficulty. Up to 80% of schizophrenic patients and up to half of the schizophrenic relatives cannot simply follow this simple pendulum. They're easily distracted. Other things occur to them internally or in the environment, and they can't do this simple task. Next, backward masking. If I show you two images, one image followed by another image, you'll see both of them. But as I shrink the time between the images, at some point, image, all you'll see is the last one. You won't see the first one. That's called backward masking. The key issue here is how long must it be between images in order for you to see both of them? Well, the simple point is that schizophrenics need more time to process this information than do normal people. Schizophrenics need half a second or longer in order to see both images, whereas normal people can get by on a quarter of a second or less. Event-related potentials. Event-related potentials are a way that we look at a stimuli and then look at the effect that stimuli has in activating a particular targeted pathway. For schizophrenics, we focus on the auditory P300 ERP. This is elicited by task-relevant stimuli. The simple result is that when given task-relevant stimuli, schizophrenics show a smaller spike along this particular pathway than normals do, suggesting that faced with task-relevant stimuli, instead of having more attention, there is decreased attention. And finally, schizophrenia is at least in part a prefrontal cortical impairment. If I give you a crossword puzzle to do, and I look at prefrontal activity, I find increased frontal lobe metabolism as you concentrate, as you think on solving this problem. If I give the schizophrenic a difficult crossword puzzle to do, I find the opposite. I find decreased frontal lobe metabolism, as if they're withdrawing from the difficult task. Now, when we do this in research, we don't use crossword puzzles. Instead, we use what's called the Wisconsin card sort task, which is a task that lets you sort cards according to certain criterions, a task that calls into mind the prefrontal part of the brain. When I give schizophrenics this Wisconsin card sort task, I find decreased frontal lobe metabolism, suggesting what? Faced with cognitive challenge, especially complex cognitive issues, schizophrenics withdraw instead of engaging as normal people do. There's a withdrawal in the face of cognitive challenge, suggesting, as stated before, they can't handle that level of stimulation. And so instead, paradoxically, they shut down. talk about structural and anatomic abnormalities. First, we have some cortical abnormalities, which are found consistently across all types of schizophrenia. The most repeated finding is larger ventricle size and VBR, ventricular brain ratio. Almost all serious schizophrenics have this finding. This is accompanied by diffuse cortical atrophy, but also generally smaller frontal lobes, and especially atrophy of the temporal lobes. There is a correlation between ventricle size and the type and progression of the schizophrenia. The larger this ventricle size, the worse the prognosis. Other structural anomalies are associated with the limbic system. You find first a smaller volume of the left hippocampus and the amygdala. Hippocampus is where, in part, we index memories. Amygdala is important in processing emotional information. You find the loss of inhibitory neurons in the second layer of the anterior cingulate gyrus. And step back and think about the limbic system overall. I want you to think about this limbic loop, the system that works together, as the site of the primary pathology for schizophrenia. This is really the source of the main symptoms that we identify and talk about. In order to have you understand this, I need to have you understand how the cortex works in conjunction with the limbic system. So let's try a simple metaphor. The metaphor is about a horse and a rider. Suppose you're watching a man riding on a horse and the horse is running wild. Well, that's because of one of two reasons. Either the horse is so strong that no matter what the man does, he can't control it, or because the rider is so weak, the horse can run and do whatever he wants, right? The limbic system is your horse. The cortical regions are the rider. When we say the limbic system is the source of primary pathology, we mean the horse is running wild, and that's for one of two reasons. Either the limbic system is so out of control, no cortical control could be exerted anyhow, or cortical control is so weak that the limbic system is spinning out of control, or possibly some combination of the two. An interesting metaphor, and one that helps you understand maybe the source of some of the subtypes of schizophrenia. A number of observers have commented that schizophrenia is not, in fact, a single disorder, but is better understood as a combination of similar disorders, which may have some overlap, but are clearly ones with different, possibly, etiology. What's the long-term course for schizophrenia? Well, if you take antipsychotic medications, that reduces your positive symptoms in about 75% of schizophrenics, rough versus about 25% with placebo. Relapse rates. If you're on your medication over 2 years, the relapse rate is about 40%. However, if you're not on your medication, you stop taking your medication, over 2 years, the relapse rate rises to 80%. General prognosis. Over the course of a lifetime for people that are schizophrenic, about one-third return to lead normal lives. You don't even know they're schizophrenic when you're talking to them, probably. About one-third experience symptoms periodically, but continue to function in society, although they may require some assistance. And about one-third require frequent hospitalizations and are really unable to function very well on their own.